Hopefully you're in Exodus 19 and 20. If you're not there, pull out your Bibles and turn to that section. We'll be starting there in just a few moments. Exodus chapters 19 and 20. Before we dive into the sermon, and I will warn you, I don't know how deep of a dive I can do into the whole law when it's, as we'll see in a moment, five books and 613 laws. I could do that today, but we would still be here next week. So just want to temper your expectations. But before we get into that, I just want to share a moment of reflection and maybe bring something else to our memory. This was a year ago tomorrow. It was the first time that we were able to meet in person. And if you don't remember that day, I don't know if you can tell by the raindrops, but you can tell by the umbrellas, this is what it looked like at the end. I will tell you that I will never forget May the 17th of 2020. In some ways, it is a modern parallel to some of the things we're going to talk about this morning. That we had a small period of time where we were enslaved, in a sense, where we couldn't be with each other. And we were delivered that day and able to be in each other's presence. I used the Bible I used that day a couple weeks ago, and there's still pages that have the effects of raindrops, and that's okay. And what I'll never forget about that was when it started raining, none of you ran for your car, because we were just happy to be together. Don't ever lose that joy when you have the opportunity to be with God's people, whether it's in a parking lot, in a rainstorm, or in an air-conditioned building like this. I think if we're not careful, the comforts we have right now, and just being our second week back, but the ability to do that, if we're not careful, we'll take all this for granted. And we'll forget the joy of being able to assemble and worship so freely and openly and together. Like in that picture, and like we are now. So just something for us to consider. And aren't we thankful that we are here together today as God's people? Amen? Amen. Well, as we move on, have you ever considered what it must have been like to be one of the children of Israel during the time of the Exodus? Here you are in captivity in Egypt, and things for your people had been going very well until there's a change in government, and that brings along with it a change in the way you're treated. You're put into servitude, but it's brutal hard work. You're being asked to make bricks and to build towers and cities. And as time goes on, they increase the difficulty of that work. They remove needed supplies and make you work harder. And you are weary and you are exhausted and tired, and you are wanting to be delivered. And finally, this 80-year-old Moses shows up and confronts a Pharaoh that he probably knew, he probably grew up with, and says, God has said, let my people go, or I'll prove to you and your gods that I am the God. And Pharaoh says no. And what follows is 10 plagues. But they are more than just plagues. They are a systematic assault by Jehovah on the gods of Egypt. They are showing definitively that God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, is superior to any of their gods. And finally, during that 10th plague, one of awful death that covers the land, you hear it's time to go. and you leave immediately. You had already been told to eat that last meal, that Passover meal, with your shoes on. Your bags were to be packed. And when the message came, it's time to go, you leave and you follow Moses and you go out until you come up against the sea. And when you get to the sea, you turn around only to see the Egyptian army pursuing you. And I'm talking about chariots and horses and men coming to destroy you. Pharaoh has changed his mind. And already in your mind, you are thinking to yourself, why did we do this? We're just going to die, until Moses suddenly raises his staff in his arms, and suddenly the sea divides, and this cloud that has been leading you, it hovers over this channel in the water of dry ground, and you are led through to the other side. And you get to the other side and you turn around and you see the waters just encompass and destroy the Egyptian army. God has provided. Can you imagine how amazing it would be to experience that? And so then you continue to go. Now you no longer are slaves. And you have been promised, and not just you, since the days of Abraham, you've been promised that you would be a nation and you would have your own land. And now Moses is saying, we're going to the land. You would think that if you were those people, you would be so amazed and your faith and your trust would be so overwhelming that you would find nothing to complain about. Yet that's just not the case. And by the way, may I warn you, if you think that you were better off than these people, that the chances are you would have complained too. Let's not have some smug sense of superiority that we think we wouldn't get upset about the things they got upset about. Because they're led out of Egypt, and yeah, they don't have to work anymore, but the water is bitter. And there's nothing to eat. And sure, God, you delivered us to the sea, but did you just bring us out here to starve? To die of dehydration? So what does God do? He puts a tree, has Moses put a tree in the water, and the bitter waters become fresh. And then he sends this dust that comes every morning, this fine powder that you collect, that you make bread out of, manna, bread from heaven. And later on, Moses goes and he produces water from a rock. And every time you complain, it seems that God, through Moses, provides. And every day, by the way, you see this cloud that is there. It's God's presence. And at night, it turns into a ball of fire. And eventually, you come to this mountain. And that cloud you've been following settles itself on top of the mountain. And as that cloud descends on the mountain shakes. And there's thunder and there's lightning. And Curtis just read that scene for us. And God calls down for Moses to come up on the mountain. And Moses goes up there and God tells him at the end of chapter 19, go tell those people not to get too close. That if they try to come up here and see me, that would not be good. And so Moses goes down Mount Sinai, and he tells the people this. And as he's doing that, what is interesting is what chapter 20 says, that while Moses is down there warning them not to try to break through into the presence of God, God starts speaking to Israel. Look at verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, that is in earth beneath, or is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Skip down to verse 12. honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that your Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female donkey, female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is in your neighbor's. We call that the Ten Commandments. And the chances are that as a child, if you went to Sunday school, you were taught to memorize those 10 things in some form. But they were 10 things that God is giving them here in Exodus 20 to be perfect. And to be perfect for a specific purpose, to be a priesthood to the nations around them. That's what God is calling Israel to do. He didn't just choose Abraham's family to be special people like they thought. He chose them to be a priesthood to the world, to reveal the glory of Jehovah, to reveal that their God, Jehovah, was the God, and all these other gods were not true. And what he is saying there is, this is how you'll be different. This is how you will be a priesthood. This is how the world will see me, because you do these things. What is interesting is how the people respond. Because the way they respond to this declaration of God is out of sheer terror. They go to Moses and say, "Hey, we're not talking to that guy anymore. You do all that. You can go up on the mountain. You can talk to God. Then you come back and give us what he needs to say. That's too scary." Now that's the modern day Francis version of verses 18 and 19. They were terrified. And what happens until the end of Deuteronomy is the story of these people becoming a nation, becoming God's people, receiving this law. And we call those five books that the Bible starts off with the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In the New Testament, when the word is used, the law, because it goes back to the Septuagint, the Greek translation, where the Torah became known as nomos, which was the law. And it's interesting that the Torah in its entirety contains 613 different laws. One of the things that came up this week that was really interesting to me is just an illustration of why these laws were given. In all of those five books, and really four, because the Torah doesn't start till the 69th chapter, the law doesn't start at the 69th chapter of the Torah, which is in Exodus. Of all of those things that are said, only one law is stated three times. And if I were to go around the room and ask you if you knew which law it was, unless you've run across this interesting fact, none of you will get it. The only law mentioned three times in the Torah is not to boil a baby goat in his mother's milk. Isn't that odd? And I share that because here's an illustration of the difference of what the purpose was. The Jews took that and they use that to develop their kosher laws, which, by the way, I don't know if you know in a kosher kitchen that the meat and the dairy are completely separated from each other because of this law. But through archaeology, what's been uncovered is that there was a pagan practice of offering a sacrifice of boiling an infant animal in the mother's milk. And I just share that with you to say that we read that law and we think, well, these are dietary restrictions. And what seems to be, now that we see these other pagan practices, is really just the emphasis. What God is saying in that law and others is, you don't be like these people. You don't worship me. You don't serve me. You don't live with me the same way they serve and worship and live with their gods. You're different. You act different. You live different. You worship differently. And that was the purpose of this law, the Torah, to show them how to be different. Now, what is interesting to me is that because we call this the law, you and I read the Torah, or at least think about the Torah in the sense of a law code, which it is not. When you think of a law code today, what a law code today would be to go to some, perhaps, law library and see the hundreds of volumes of specific laws, one right after another, that are listed in order to reference in a court of law or some other application. Here's your code of law. Here's the things. Here's all the laws of the land. And you might think to yourself, well, wait a minute. That sounds a whole lot like Leviticus and Numbers. But it's really not. In fact, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers are very interestingly not presented as a law code. In fact, think about Leviticus, which, yeah, there's a lot of things about the priesthood and a lot of things about the sacrifices and how to be consecrated and all of those things. But you know what else you find in the story of Leviticus? The story of Nadab and Abihu, which isn't law code, but a story about two priests who failed to keep the very things that the book of Leviticus is about. And in the book of Numbers, you see a censor, numbering of the people, but you see more laws. But what else do you see? You see a rebellion against Moses. You see a plague that is sent. You see a battle where they are defeated. You see Moses striking the rock instead of speaking to it and being told he can't enter the land. You see the spies delivering the report and being rejected. You see story after story after story in the book of Numbers. Imagine reading about the Exodus by removing all of the passages that are found in Numbers. All of which is to say this: the Torah is not a law code. It is presented as a story to us, or as a narrative. Instead of just one huge delivery of the law of Moses, what we see is a cycle of sorts that is the story of God's people, of Israel. And here's what you see. God gives the law in some portion. Israel fails to keep the law. God gives more law, and Israel fails to keep the law. And that cycle starts from the very beginning of Exodus chapter 19, where we just read, where this interaction at Sinai begins. Because what you see is Moses comes down, God delivers the Ten Commandments. The people say, hey, you go up there, we're not going up there. And Moses goes up, and as Joe mentioned in the talk earlier, he's there for 40 days and 40 nights receiving a chunk of the law that lasts from chapter 21 to chapter 23. He comes down in chapter 24. He presents that law. The people agree to be in a covenant with him. He goes back up on the mountain. And what is interesting is they've agreed to be in this covenant. They understand what it means. They've heard the Ten Commandments. But when Moses goes back on the mountain and comes back, what does he come back to? Israel breaking the first two commands of the Ten Commandments. They have built for themselves a graven image, and they have put a God, lowercase g, ahead of Jehovah. And so Moses comes down to them violating the very covenant they have just agreed to keep. So what do? They have to agree to the covenant again. And what you see is this beginning of the cycle where Moses then delivers law and they violate it, and he delivers more law. That's exactly what's going on in the focus of the priesthood in Leviticus. There's these laws about sacrifices. What do Nadab and Abihu do? They go in and they offer the wrong kind of incense, wrong kind of fire. law violation, more law. You get to Numbers, it's interesting the cycle there. In chapter 11, the people complain, and so they're given quail. But then when they get the quail, they turn into gluttons, and as a result, a lot of them die from a plague, which means what? There are dead bodies. The spies go out. They come back. They say the land is great, but there's going to be a lot of people that they can't defeat, these giants. And so the people say, well, we can't go. And the result is God says, fine, then this generation won't get to go. By the way, you know what that means? More dead bodies. That's important. Then there's a battle against the Amalekites and the Canaanites. And Moses says, don't go. And they go anyway. Guess what happens? More dead bodies. You know what happens soon after those stories in Numbers 19? Moses delivers the laws from God about purification. And you know what specifically is contained in those laws? How to handle dead bodies. You have law, you have failure to keep the law, more law. You have this cycle going over and over and over again. And the question then becomes, if that's the way the Torah is delivered to us, and it's not a law code but a story, what is the point of the story? What am I supposed to learn from the story? And here's what you learn. Israel could not keep the law. Now, I know the way that is said seems to be to us wrong. What do you mean Israel could not keep the law? But I have to tell you, that is exactly what the Torah points to, is Israel is incapable of keeping the law. And Deuteronomy is what points to this more than any other book. Because in Deuteronomy, what he does is that last generation has died. And now in chapters 12 through about chapter 26, Moses sits down this generation that will be led by Joshua into the land of Canaan, crossing the Jordan, conquering the land, and he retells them the covenant. And in that retelling of the covenant and the law, by the way, there's some other laws that weren't in the first telling of the law. But as he does that, then in chapter 27, he brings all of them and he puts half of them at Mount Ebal and he puts the other half of them at Mount Gerizim, and he talks about this tremendous section about blessings and curses. That if you do the things here in this law, God will bless you and you'll receive the land and you'll be taken care of and the land will continue to flow with milk and honey. But, and this is how Moses presents it, in the day that you don't, God's going to afflict you, and he's going to punish you. And eventually, he's going to carry you off into captivity. And what is interesting is the way that Moses addresses this in chapter 30 of Deuteronomy in verses 15 through 18. And by the way, I want you to consider this just in the context of an athletic event, and you have a coach, okay? Or maybe a war, and this is your general. This is your pep talk. With that in mind, read verse 15 and 18 through 18. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you're entering to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away and you will not hear, and you are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you will surely perish. You will not live long in the land you're going over to the Jordan to enter and possess. You know, pep talks usually are, hey, let's go win. Victory's right there. And Moses says, hey, if you go over and be this way, this is what you're going to get. But if you go over and do this, which is what you're going to do, this is what's going to happen. Moses, in essence, in chapter 30 of Deuteronomy, tells them, you're going to fail. You're going to fail. Let me ask you the question, why? Why is it that these people were incapable of following the law? Why is it that they were going to fail? Back up in chapter 30 to verses 4 through 6. If your outcast are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you and take you from there, and the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, and you may possess it. and he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers, and the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your life. Moses says that when this happens, there will come a time that God will go and he will bring you back from wherever you are and he will bless you again. But when he does that, he's going to fix your heart. He's going to circumcise your heart. He's going to cut away the dead skin, the callous parts of your heart. He's going to fix your heart. What Moses is saying to these people here is that the reason they are incapable of keeping the law is because their heart is wrong. Their heart is wrong. Their hearts have been hardened. And the only way for that to be fixed is for their hearts to be transformed, to be changed, to be different. By the way, the prophets speak to this as well. In Ezekiel chapter 36, verses 24 through 26, Ezekiel says, and he's in captivity in Babylon, I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you. You shall be clean from your uncleanness. Your idols I will cleanse you. I will give you a new heart and a new spirit will I put into you. Jeremiah says in chapter 24 and verses 5 through 7 that he's going to give them a new heart. But more importantly, in chapter 31, he describes what the main difference is going to be in this heart. He says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband. Verse 33, for this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord, I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Ezekiel says that when you are gathered back, God is going to change your heart. And Jeremiah says the way he's going to change your heart is the word is going to be in your heart, not on tables of stone, but in your heart. And the book of Isaiah says that there will be a Messiah that comes, a leader who leads them in obedience to the law, but also gives them this new heart. But there is a problem that exists. And that, as the Hebrew writer tells us, is that this covenant, this testament, can't be removed, as Jeremiah is saying it will be, until it has been kept. Which is why Jesus is so important when he comes to fulfill the law. And Joe spoke of this in his talk earlier. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 and verses 17 through 20, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one iota, not one dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom. Whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus says, I came to keep it, to fulfill it, and none of it will be gone until it has been fulfilled. I want to suggest to you this morning that Jesus didn't just keep the law or fulfill the law. He was the embodiment of the law. The law was designed to make the Israelites perfect so that they could abide with God in a covenant relationship and be a priesthood to the world around them and reveal who God was. Jesus abided with God, and he is, as Paul said, the full revelation of who God is. Jesus was the perfect embodiment of the Torah. But Jesus does something else in his fulfillment of the Torah. Jesus says it is easier than keeping 613 commands. In fact, I will tell you that Moses and God had tried to tell them it was easier than that. The reality is, those 10 laws God started off with, they're a summation of the other 613 laws. And if they had found a way to practice those 10 commandments in the way they should have been practiced, well, they wouldn't have had the need for the 613 laws. But they failed. Jesus is asked in Matthew chapter 22 in verses 35 through 40, a lawyer comes and says, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment of the law?" And Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love the neighbor, your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." Jesus came to fulfill the law, but he also says, listen, the law is really two laws. Love God and love other people. That's what the law is. And that's confusing, isn't it? Because when we hear that, we go, hey, I like to love people. I'm a lovable guy. But you know what Jesus said not long after he said he came to fulfill the law? He went into a discussion that we call the Sermon on the Mount, where he explains why we struggle with those two things so much. For instance, just take the idea of murder. Jesus, in that section in Matthew chapter 5, quotes the law, "You shall not murder." And Jesus says, if you do that, you do well. But when you disrespect other people and you treat them harshly and you respond in anger and you call them things that you should not call them, you have failed to keep the law. Why? Because you didn't love them. Oh, you loved them not enough to murder them, but you didn't love them enough to not get angry. You didn't love them enough not to label them and slander them and malign them. You didn't love them enough to not disrespect them. And if the law is about loving God and loving other people, then you see what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 5 is really emphasizing that idea. It's not just about avoiding breaking those 613 laws in the Torah. It's about a different kind of heart. And as if this teaching about loving other people needed a final exclamation mark, he goes on later to say, let me tell you how much you have to change. You got to love your enemies. Wait a minute. Jesus, you've gone too far. No, that was the point of the law. Love others. Love God, love others. And your enemies are part of the others. So Israel fails to keep the commands. Jesus comes in and he fulfills all of the commands. And as the Messiah, he puts on display to the world how you love God and love others, as he never operated outside of the will of the Father. And as he showed unmeasurable compassion and mercy to everyone around them, even the enemies who nailed him to the cross, he says, Father, forgive them. And even when he submitted to the cross, he did so loving his enemies, of who I am chief, because it was my sins that caused him to hang there. And so he died. And then he is raised. And after his resurrection, Jesus tells his followers that he's going to send the Spirit, who will come and change their hearts so they can keep the law. By the way, if that makes you uncomfortable, I want you to look at what Romans chapter 2 and verses 28 and 29 says. For no one is a Jew who is merely one outwardly, nor is circumcision outward and physical, but a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God. That circumcision of the heart in Romans chapter 2, Paul says it's the Spirit who circumcises that heart. Just, by the way, just like the prophets pointed to. And that's what the story of the Torah is. How incapable we are to keep the law. But that Jesus, which Paul describes the Torah as the schoolmaster to point us to Christ, right? That Jesus comes and he fulfills the law and he teaches us what it means to truly serve God, to love God and love others. And he sends the Spirit so that we can walk by the Spirit and we can be truly changed. And we can be a priesthood to the nations around us. What Peter described as a holy nation and a royal priesthood, so that the world can see Jesus in us. The difference then is simple. We can become that priesthood today because Jesus came and offers us the gift not only of redemption, but the gift of a Spirit-filled heart, that when we submit to God and in the entirety, Father, Son, and Spirit, we are changed and transformed. And we can serve God the way that was always expected. The Torah was 10 ways really to be perfect, but it was a part of a greater story that pointed to Jesus and our redemption and our transformation through Him. And aren't you thankful that Jesus fulfilled the law and offered us that redemption? Puts us into this new covenant that we talked about earlier with Joe, where now our hearts are changed and they're transformed. And we can do and be the priesthood Israel never became. The law is summed up in two things. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And love one another.